What is up, and welcome to 24 Minutes of the Oscars, the podcast that takes a look at the 2024 Oscars 24 minutes at a time. I am Ethan Simi.
And I'm Ben Lawhorn. This week on the pod, we are exploring the world around us and ourselves as we talked about Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things.
The incredible tale about the fantastical evolution of Bella Baxter, a young woman brought back to life by the brilliant and unorthodox scientist, Dr. Godwin Baxter. This is Best Picture number 4 for us, Ben. Mm-hmm. We find ourselves in a little bit of a precarious pickle here. And before I say what that might be, I want to introduce our really exciting guest for Poor Things to talk about this really wonderful movie with us, Annie Janes of the Movie Mavens podcast. Annie, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk about Poor Things. So a little bit behind the scenes, this is going to be our 4th Best Picture pod out of 10 that we're doing for the Oscars season. But we are recording it about a week and a half before it's going to release. What that means is that by the time this episode comes out, the Oscars nomination lists, not only for Best Picture, but for every single category, will be out. We will have solidified nominations in which we can prognosticate our little minds out for figuring out who's going to win those actual lists. But right now, at time of recording, and has been the case the last few episodes, we're just guessing. And so this is the last of our guessing pods, Ben, which I feel pretty good about.
Yeah, I feel like we've done a decent job of what we've predicted so far, especially with the way the awards season has gone. So I feel good about it. I'm excited to talk about this movie today.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Annie, since the lists are not out yet at time of recording, are you making any other Oscar predictions? Are you involved in this? Or are you just kind of like watching the Oscars for fun?
I mean, truly, truly, honestly, I have no skin in this game. Who am I? I'm nobody. But
you're Annie fucking hey, James.
Yeah, you're Annie. Come on.
And I honestly, I don't make predictions until really close to the Oscars. And I don't really make predictions on who's going to be nominated. But once I have that list, then I go hard. And I nice. Will say I have won many a raffle okay. with my predictions. But the really? Key is I got to make them like the day before. Like I have to physically feel it out. All the pre-Oscar season. If I were to call it now, it'd be totally wrong.
Yeah, it's but hard. I will now. Do it. Yeah. So now we go through all 12
every
categories.
Single yeah. nom. Yeah.
It's tough for sure. I think Ben, you beat me out last year on your correct predictions. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I do remember Whoa. That specifically.
Yeah, I think you only won by like one or two. I don't know if there's a very much so. In there.
All I remember is I only got two wrong, and both of them were, I believe, due to Babylon. So I blame
fucking
you.
Fucking A.
So.
God damn it. Don't blame me, man. Blame the Academy. That's brutal stuff. That's brutal. Yeah, so this episode, even though it doesn't make sense in real time, we'll still be guessing who is going to be nominated for Best Picture. We're going to be guessing who's going to be nominated for Best Cinematography. We're going to be talking about that in relation to Poor Things. And of course, having ourselves a little Emma Stone conversation as well, because at time of recording, Critics' Choice just happened last night. And little surprise, little interesting, Poor Things, getting a little extra juice. Annie, you mentioned you don't guess, you don't predict Oscars really until like the day before. But what is your history with the Oscars? Have you been watching it for a long time? Do you have a history with it, or do you more so just come for the enjoyment?
I do have a history with it. I think I started watching the Oscars. My first like big memory of it was the Catherine Bigelow, James Cameron. Mm. Avatar and Hurt Locker year.
Yeah.
Which means I was a teenager. So I've been watching it since then, which feels like a long time, but I think the last 2 years I skipped out on it. I didn't watch it live. And I don't know why. I think there was like 1 year where it was really a quite a dud. And then I just felt like, okay, that's it. No more. I don't need to watch this live anymore. I can get those like 4 or 5 hours back.
Yeah.
Fair.
But I think it's also like my inner relationship with award shows has also been shifting over time. Like when I was in high school, I was like probably close to tears if someone wins, just because I'm like, oh, I feel so proud of that. And like, I can't imagine what that would feel like. And then now it's just like, it feels like when you know that reality shows aren't real anymore, it feels like, oh, well, there's actually like money and campaigning involved. Yeah.
Sure.
One moment, please. Sorry.
Can we talk about that very briefly, about the money in the campaigning? Just because at time of recording this, so Paul Giamatti did win for Best Actor last night at the Critics' Choice, and I'm sure that we're going to talk about this on other episodes of the podcast as well. But the reason I bring that up is because he did go kind of viral over the last week for going to In-N-Out after winning his Golden Globe, actually, and enjoying two burgers, no fries. And he's been questioned about this a lot. And
you're saying it's a conspiracy.
Look,
the conspiracy runs deep.
In-N-Out is nothing new to like the marketing game when it comes to award season. It's been a pretty clutch player for a while now. But I bring this up because you're definitely right, Annie, in the fact that some people get it and some people want to be part of that game and other people don't, which is always a very fascinating juxtaposition of like seeing what might happen to Paul Giamatti. And he's asked, and he's like, I just went there because I like good burgers. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, do you think he went there just because he likes good burgers? Or was his PR person like, you got to go, you're going to sit down at the table, you're going to put the Golden Globe on the outside of the table, someone's going to snap a picture, it's going to go viral, and this will boost your campaign leading to the Academy Awards?
Okay, I actually hadn't considered this at all. Like when I was talking about money and campaigning, like I just meant it not attached to this moment, but now that you're tying the two together.
I mean, I want to believe it's authentic. I do. Yeah. Paul Giamatti.
I don't think it is. It feels like,
whoa,
Kristen Bell and the burrito. You guys remember this?
No, what is this?
There was just like a year where she showed up to an award show with like a burrito in her purse. But it wasn't just that moment. It was like pictures she's posting on her Instagram in the dressing room with the burrito and things like that. This is a very vague memory. I could be a little off about this, but it feels calculated. Who knows?
Yeah, it's hard. No, I mean, it reminded me of what Patton did, you know, forever ago. When was he outside like Arby's or something like that after he won his award? It felt similar to that. I don't know. It's a bummer to think if it's calculated that way, but
it is
also hard not to think of it as being calculated, just knowing what the PR machine is like for all these actors.
So in that case, I have to ask, because we're talking about this topic and this is our podcast and we're talking about the Oscars, because I have to talk to somebody about this. I have to talk to my people here. I'm going to bring it back to Bradley Cooper, because this is a very interesting, interesting thing for me. I cannot rein it in when it comes to Bradley Cooper. He wants the Oscar, right? He's trying very hard.
Apparent.
He's making the rounds. He's interviewing. He's telling people how badly he wants this. Why does his team not just basically tell him, like, look, take it easy, cool off. All you got to do, go to In-N-Out afterwards. You don't even have to win an award. Just go with somebody who won an award and be a man of the people and play it on the more low-key side. Why can't we not? You know what I mean?
He doesn't feel like a listen to his team kind of guy. He doesn't strike
me as a man of the people.
Yeah.
Like, he's not cool enough to pull that off.
Where's he going? If Bradley Cooper is going to pull this off, where is he going? What restaurant? Because not In-N-Out. That's way too much of the people.
It's somewhere in like the Grove where it's still like fancy. And
he's going
to a
steakhouse probably.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. If I had my way, he'd go to like Sizzler or something like that, but he's not going to pull that off.
Yeah, go to Chili's. Go to a Margaritaville. That could be good. That's like a good mix. See that guy enjoying a margarita at Margaritaville? I think we need to become Bradley Cooper's PR team for this Oscar.
just tease us with Hangover 4. That's all we need. Be like, if you guys will give me this, I'll stop doing serious stuff.
No. Okay. I gotta begging you, Bradley. Please. I got a pull in from my Bradley Cooper getting
just be handsome
here.
And funny. It's all we want. It's all we want from you. Please.
No, please. Okay. So lots of things do go into the Academy Awards, obviously, and the lead into it. We've got about 6 or 7 weeks to go until the award show happens, the biggest night in Hollywood. Let's break down Poor Things before we talk about the film. Let's talk about what we think it's going to be nominated for. Of course, again, we will know what it is nominated for by the time this podcast comes out, but we don't know right now. And so we're playing this little game. And once people can listen to this show, then we can actually figure out how many we got right and guess what it will have been nominated for. Of course, Best Picture. That's why we're covering this here on the show. Best Director, Yorgos Lanthimos. Best Actress, Emma Stone. Best Actor in a Supporting Role, Willem Dafoe and or Mark Ruffalo. I don't know. Let's put a pin in that. We'll come back to that. Adapted screenplay, production design, cinematography, costume design, film editing, makeup and hairstyling, visual effects. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 are on that list right now. Annie, do you think it gets nominated for all 11 of those categories?
The only one I'm unsure on, I feel like I saw it left out of Best Director in some of these lists.
Which, I think that's the most on the bubble right now.
And then in terms of Best Supporting, it could be both. It could be one or the other. That one's really hard to call. But honestly, I think it gets nominated for all of these. Whether it wins, we'll have to see about that.
Yeah.
what do you think, though?
It feels like something's going to get a lot of nominations, but not a lot of wins. I'm curious about makeup and hairstyling, but I think that's maybe because I'm still sour about Priscilla, you know, and I'm just like, I feel like that had more than this movie does. And this movie, I don't know. I mean, still great hairstyling stuff, but probably more costume design and production design. I'm very curious if both the supporting roles will get nominated, because that's not far-fetched for a Yorgos film, because we got that with The Favorite, where Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz were both nominated for supporting, and then Olivia Colman for lead.
For lead.
So it'd be kind of interesting.
And Olivia Colman won that year, didn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
So it'd be kind of interesting to see if that happens again, because I think both Dafoe and Ruffalo are, you know, worthy of being nominated, but obviously it's a big field for sure.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll get nominated for all 11 of these. I think the big ones that I could see it missing out on, I think really like Best Director is the most on the bubble for me right now. I feel like production design, costume design, like visual effects, I feel like those are kind of locks for this movie. So seeing it have the potential to have double digit nominations is big. The Willem Dafoe, Mark Ruffalo thing is interesting because it always brings up this conversation of, does that split the vote, right? And we saw this happen last year with Everything Everywhere All at Once, where we get Stephanie Hsu and Jamie Lee Curtis, both as a supporting actress, and actually don't split the votes. We give it to Jamie Lee Curtis. I'm curious if both get nominated, could that be beneficial for Poor Things as a whole? Or, like you said, Ben, does that maybe add to the, you know what, let's just nominate it a lot and we'll just goose egg it like The Irishman?
I kind of lean towards that. I think it's just going to get a lot of nominations and not a lot of, like, that's the recognition it's going to get. It's not going to get a lot of winning recognition. Emma Stone, I think, has probably the best chance out of this list, but even then, coming up against Lily Gladstone, it's going to be, it's tough, you know, it's really hard to do, but yeah, I don't know. It's just, I think the recognition is going to be in the nominations.
I feel like if this were a different year, maybe the past few years when there was sort of a lull in movies coming out, this movie could have easily been like the one that's winning the most Oscars. It just feels like a really stacked year in terms of like award darling kind of movies.
It does. And I think that's a very interesting segue into the Emma Stone situation. Now, I know we talked about Best Actress when we talked about Barbie a couple of weeks ago, But I kind of want to harken that conversation back a little bit, because at least for me, and I feel like most of the predictions that are floating out there right now, does see Lily Gladstone taking Best Actress at the Academy Awards. But Emma Stone won at the Critics' Choice Awards for Best Actress, and I think that was quite an unexpected win for her. Does that win have the power and have the juice to drive Emma Stone to a Best Actress win and maybe help Poor Things out as a whole kind of really gain that momentum? Because Poor Things, I think at time of recording, is still not like crazy nationwide. It's still like a little bit of a limited release. So it feels like that could be the quote unquote like beginning of the late stage surge for a Poor Things takeover.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think if it goes wide, that could help it out for sure. But I think something else to keep in mind is I don't know. There's a lot of crossover between the Critics' Choice Award and the Oscars as far as like the voting body.
That's what I was wondering too. And again, back to this is me thinking about the money. Like, are they like campaigning for an Oscar and they're just like, well, we don't really care about the Critics' Awards. It seems like a lower.
Yeah,
a lower tier award show. So like, I wonder if that has anything to do with it too.
Yeah, I mean, super possible, but I do think it's down to her and Lily. And I think we saw that in the Golden Globes because they both won for their respective categories. It's an interesting debate, I think, and maybe one that we can get into, because I think Emma Stone is given a lot more to do in this movie than Lily is in Killers of the Flower Moon. But that performance from Lily Gladstone is just amazing. It's a fantastic performance. So I'm curious to see, but it feels like it's down to the two of them for sure.
Two extreme point.
Yeah.
Just that Emma Stone like is in every moment of Poor Things, and she's carrying the whole film on this like character, versus Lily Gladstone is playing a very specific role for most of the film.
Yeah.
The Oscars also historically like to re-award people. Emma Stone, this could be her second win here that we see. Whereas, like, conversely, for Lily Gladstone, this has the narrative behind it of this might be her chance. Like, we don't know if she'll ever get to this position again, or if she'll ever find herself in this kind of a movie or situation or field of nominees again where she could win. So I think that's a really interesting narrative for the Best Actress race, which I think is shaping up to be one of the more interesting races. And even if it is a little bit more like locked down towards Lily Gladstone, I think there's some really fascinating narratives with both of them. Yorgos Lanthimos did get nominated at the DGA nominations for Directors Guild. He was one of the five. And then at the Golden Globes, Poor Things got 7 nominations, 1 win. And I think that does speak a little bit to your idea of like, maybe it's all nominations and no wins, because the only category it won was for Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy. And let's be honest, the only reason it won that is because there is a drama category and a musical or comedy category. If there's one, I don't think it wins it. And that's a lot of nominations to only walk away with 1 win.
Well, I mean, it did win 2. The other thing that it won was for Best Performance from a Female Actor in a Musical or Comedy. So
right, okay.
It won Best. But yeah, it's the same principle between the two, which is like, yeah, it won it because it's a separate thing. But now if it's going up against, you know, the Oppenheimer / Killers of the Flower Moon of it all, like that's a tough hill to climb. So, yeah, I don't know. It's tough. I think that's why Golden Globes are also so fun, because we get 2 winners, you know. It's like, oh, okay, this is cool. We can kind of then pit these two against each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Yorgos gets nominated for DGA. We still think he's on the bubble for directors of the 5 for the Academy Awards. I don't know.
I'm just curious how many directors are in the voting body. You know what I mean? Because I was looking it up with Golden Globes. That's like 150 people are voting on that. Like, it's not a huge group. And the Academy is something like 7,800 people.
Yeah.
So it's curious to hear, you know, how many of those people say like, well, what do the Directors Guild, what directors did they choose? Like, do they respect that voting body for that category more? Or are they just kind of going with their heart? Because I think that happens a lot, you know, where it's just like, okay, so what, like, the editors, what do they recognize? Because maybe I should recognize that too. And if that's the case, then maybe Yorgos makes it in. I mean, he'd be worthy of it, in my opinion.
What do you think, Danny?
He would be worthy of it. And that thought is hard to separate from like what you think is going to happen versus what you want to happen. Mm-hmm. And I want him to get this nom because I think he is worthy of it. I'm going to say that he does get it.
He gets in.
But does him getting it mean that something else major wouldn't get it? Is there many noms?
I think right now we've got Christopher Nolan, Martin Scorsese, Alexander Payne for The Holdovers, Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest, and Greta Gerwig for Barbie. Those are the five that Variety is predicting right now, with Yorgos being on the sixth bubble. I think out of that, I think that personally Payne misses out for The Holdovers. If that's the case, I just feel you've got to have Greta. We know Christopher Nolan and Martin Scorsese are a lock. And I cannot help but think that everybody voting and being nominated will understand the importance of Jonathan Glazer. And like, this is the movie to nominate him for. But I could be totally wrong because we're talking about this right now in the past. Yeah. So this will already be sorted when this pod comes out.
Yeah. I think it might be Jonathan Glazer that gets the boot and Yorgos gets the nom.
No, don't speak that into existence, Annie.
Talk about them liking to repeat noms. I mean, Yorgos has been nominated 3 times already, only once for directing. But, you know, it's kind of the same theory as the Emma Stone theory. It's like, well, we've done it once. Like, let's bring him back. Like,
yeah.
So, and that's same with Alexander Payne. They really like him a lot as well. But I see your argument with Alexander Payne because I could see them rewarding him with the writing, you know, as opposed to the directing, which Yorgos isn't up for with Poor Things.
Yeah, which is, you know, some interesting narratives around that as well. Like, come this Oscar season about, like, you know, American Fiction might be this kind of underdog. If it gets nominated for Best Picture, it might, like, pull a spotlight and just win Best Pick and totally. go on everything else. So I think there's a lot of interesting narratives, like, the closer we get to the Academy Awards. What do you guys think Poor Things is going to walk away with at the end of the night of the Academy Awards? Do you think it will win any trophy? This is the moment to put it out into the world.
I'll start. I think it's going to get costume design.
Mm-hmm.
Production design.
Mm.
And Best Actress.
Nice.
As of now.
Going with Best Actress.
As of now, I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Like
Ben, what do you got for the dubs?
I think I might say nothing, but my top two would be costume and production. But my other top two out of that is Barbie. And that's a hard thing to go up against as well for both costume and production design. Like, they both of these movies have great costumes and great production design. So it'll be hard. And I feel like I don't know what they're going to give Barbie, really. And so that might be kind of where it goes, but that we're falling into that with a lot of these things here. Cause it kind of feels like director and picture are maybe not locked up, but kind of, you know, assumed what's going to happen there. So if it's anything, I think it's costume or production design.
I think it gets nominated for probably 9 to 11. I don't want to put a definite number because I'm a coward and I don't know what it'll end up. I don't want to be wrong on what it's going to be nominated for. I think it walks home with costume design, and I think the Academy splits the vote. I think it goes Poor Things for costume design, Barbie for production design. And I think the only other toss up that I could see it like truly competing for would be makeup and hairstyling. But it just feels to me that it's either Maestro or Oppenheimer in that category. We'll see how much, you know, steam Oppenheimer gains below the line as well. That's a whole narrative in and of itself. So I think it walks home with one out of a potential double digits. Poor Things might have the biggest uphill battle of any movie right now going into the Academy Awards because it is so like talked about and hyped around and like the Emma Stone of everything, but it's also it's finds itself in this really weird middle ground of like not being American Fiction potentially, where it's like look out, this movie might come out of nowhere, and it's not Oppenheimer, and it's not Killers of the Flower Moon. So it's in this weird, like,
the Academy loves to do that. It's like, here's a pile of really, like, a handful of really potential Best Picture nominees, and then the Academy's like, but look over there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think Poor Things finds itself in a really interesting predicament.
Ethan,
well,
before we move on,
yeah,
how sad are you going to be if we don't get to do a Maestro episode?
I'm going to be so fucking heartbroken, Ben. I
feel
can't
like,
even tell you.
I feel like this you've talked about the movie enough in every other episode that we don't
every
need
episode.
To do an episode on Maestro. But yeah, I feel like, yeah, you're going to be heartbroken.
I will be very, very heartbroken. And I guess the next episode of this pod that comes out after this, we'll maybe have a deeper conversation, because we'll know then if Maestro will be nominated for Best Picture or any other categories. Yeah. Look, there's still hope for Best Director. Who knows? For Bradley
Cooper.
You can't
be as sad as Bradley will be if
that's
he doesn't
true.
Get
him. You got to let him be the John Magaro of the Oscars. Let him be a sad boy. Okay?
Yeah, let him fulfill that sad boy spot. We will definitely be having a reaction episode on January 23rd. So our podcast will have that. When this comes out, that'll already happen. So everybody already knows that that happened. Okay, are you guys ready to talk about Poor Things? Break it down a little bit? Talk about the film?
Let's do it.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Ben, yeah. I'm gonna throw to you a little bit, man, because you just saw this movie about an hour or two ago. Amy mm-hmm. saw it a couple of weeks ago. I saw it about a month ago. So I've got the biggest gap here between my viewing and my speaking, and you're fresh, man.
I am fresh.
That's a lot of pressure.
Am I taking over True Cinema here? Is this
do
a,
it, man.
A pod first?
It. Yeah, pod first.
God
why
damn.
Not?
Do you want to go over general thoughts on the movie, or do you just want to dive right into True Cinema?
Let's do general thoughts. Annie, let's start with you. I'm curious what you think about Poor Things as a whole.
As a whole, I really, really liked this movie, but I don't think I loved it.
Okay.
Yeah, I liked some of Yorgos's others more. While I was watching it, I was like, I don't know how much I like this. But by the time it was over, I was like, yeah, that was really, really, really good. We can dive into more of those criticisms I have later, and but sure. mostly praises.
Nice. All right. Sure. I like that.
I feel similarly, to be honest. I think I really, really liked it, but I don't think I like fell in love with it. I think the more that I think about this, and like I wanted to go see it a second time. Unfortunately, snow hit Portland, and when it snows in Portland, the whole city acts as if it's at the end of times. So everything shuts down. You can't go anywhere. So I wasn't able to see it a second time. And I know it was like outside of my top 10 of 2023. I don't think it was as close to that list as I thought it was going to be. Much funnier than I anticipated. Quite hysterical film. And a really fun movie to watch and like be transported to this type of a world, like this type of thing that exists that is just not real, that is being like totally owned by Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo and the amazing cast and Yorgos, having these really interesting and fascinating directing styles with the frames that he does. But the one thing that I've been thinking about is how rewatchable is this movie? Because for me, the last 20 minutes or the last 25 minutes of the movie where Christopher Abbott shows up and we kind of get this like really sidebar story of what's going on, that was all shock value. Now I know going in to this film, again, what's to be expected and what might or what is going to happen. And I wonder if it loses some of that like rewatchability value. But I really did enjoy it.
That's interesting. I'm curious, like, as you said that, it's just like, how much of Yorgos's filmography
is
rewatchable? You know what I mean? Because it is kind of just like, you know, I don't throw on Dogtooth real quick, you know, or just like killing the sacred
deer.
Let
me toss on the lobster, please.
Yeah, I got 2 hours to kill. What am I going to do?
That's fair.
But I mean, I totally hear what both of you guys are saying. I left the theater with a new favorite from Yorgos.
I really
had a great time with this movie. It does make me wonder, though, you know, you guys are a bit removed from it. So like, will my, you know, love for it kind of dwindle over time? I'm not sure. But as of right now, I thought it was great. I thought it was his funniest movie. I loved, as we've been talking about, the production design, the cinematography. I thought was fantastic. Like it's my this is his first since The Favorite, but that was, you know, that was my favorite stuff that he had shot. And we got a lot more of that kind of style here with the fisheye lens and all that stuff, which I thought was used really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
The performances were great. Just seeing the progression of Emma Stone's character throughout the movie was so interesting to me. I thought she was just, yeah, just wonderful in here. And then same with everybody else. Ruffalo was just like so weird in the best way, you know, that he gets allowed to be weird. And Defoe, you're not, I don't know. It's weird to like have a character where you're very aware of his facial prosthetics, but you're just like, no, that's cool. I get it. Like that's yeah. that guy, you know, it's like, that makes sense for sure.
I just think it's funny that they like, all they had to do was slap like one prosthetic on Defoe and they're like, he's a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's basically Frankenstein's monster now. Yeah.
What did you guys think of his bubble, his burping bubble bit?
I mean, again, like that's kind of some of the stuff I love because like it's never really explained, you know, it's just like we're just going to have some of this surreal. There's these very few surreal things like all the animals that are like half of the other animal, you know, it's just and we kind of just live with that in the world. But I was able to just accept it. I'm like, yeah, I guess that makes sense, you know, and mm-hmm. even the same of all the different cities where it's like, yeah, I guess this is like this world's Lisbon. They have like a floating trolley system, you know, like that kind of thing. It's like, cool. All right, great. You know, like that's awesome. So I don't know. I bought into it, burps and all, you know?
Yeah. I love the burps. I love that they were introduced like with no like context or fanfare.
Yeah.
And then like later on in the middle of the movie, I think he's explaining to his like his ward / Bella Baxter's first fiance that it is another example of how his father was like abusive towards him in the name of science.
Mm-hmm.
Which was like an interesting through line for his character. Yeah. But it was also a fun piece of set deck. It felt like very whimsical to me and mm-hmm. It added up to all that other stuff you were talking about too. I quite liked it.
I wonder if this is the most fantastical / like joyous Lanthimos movie that exists.
Yeah. I would think so for sure. Yeah, I think so.
And that was why I thought I would love it. Like I thought this mm-hmm. was going to be maybe like not only a favorite film of the year, but I thought maybe it could be, you know, one of my favorites of all time
mm-hmm.
because of, like, I really like Lanthimos, but seeing the whimsical world that Poor Things had ahead of seeing the movie, I thought that it was going to be like amazing to me. And it didn't quite hit that, but I still really liked it. It wasn't that for me.
Yeah. As we go through this movie, I think the one thing for me that I kept thinking back to was this movie from 1967, this French film called Belle de Jour. It's obviously heavily in like an homage to this film, which is very much of a similar idea, not necessarily the Frankenstein aspect of Bella Baxter, but this woman's liberation through sexual independence and what that means to her and what that means to her world. I recommend anybody check that movie out if you liked Poor Things or if you liked those sections and those moments of Poor Things and that theme and idea. Belle de Jour is definitely worth watching. And I think that, to me, is a very, very excellent film. And this felt similar to that, just completely different in like its set design and its kind of monstrosity effects that it does. Let's do the first true cinema, Ben, meeting Bella.
Yeah, I mean, we start out here. The film starts with this push in on this woman who's standing on a bridge and mm-hmm. we see her kind of like jump off. We have no idea who it is or any of the context behind it. That's just kind of it. And then we cut to meeting Bella in the present day and she's very infant like, you know, a lot of screaming, like not able to say bye, but like, you know, like just these. We're seeing these things that just remind you of a child, basically, smashing the plates, just all this kind of activity. I thought it was just a great way to set the stage of like, this is where we're at with this character right now. Everyone around her is just accepting of this. So it's like, okay, this is normal, at least in this world. So we can buy into it. But the stumbling with the walking and all that kind of stuff, I just thought it was a real great way to set up a character for us to get to know.
Yeah. Do you think Emma Stone walked around her house like that to prep for this role?
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, without a doubt, I think that'd be pretty fun preparation for a role. Just like, I thought that's what was so interesting here, because there's a way to do it that I think is bad. It's almost like when you see a bad drunk scene, you know, when someone's play drunk and it's like, you're not drunk. And I don't know if you've ever been drunk, because this looks really bad, you know? But watching her do this, I was like, oh, that's like, it's believable. Like, what would an infant look like in a, you know, woman who's in her late 20s, early 30s? What would that look like? It's like, that's probably what it would look like. It was very believable to me.
Yeah. It's a really comical introduction to this world and this character as well, because we obviously get to see all like the physical manifestations, but we also get to see Defoe as Dr. Godwin Baxter and what he means, and like what his, like what he means in her life and what his job really like is. Like, he, this is like what he does. He's just a mad scientist. Annie, what did you think about this opening?
I really liked it, and I liked the suspense of not knowing exactly like what or how she was.
Yeah.
And maybe having an assumption. But then the scene where you finally get to know what happened to her, as told by Willem Dafoe's character, was like one of my favorites of the whole movie. I thought it was so, that was one of the funniest moments for me.
Yeah.
The part where he says, like, so obviously I, like, and then he goes on to explain what he did. And I just love the confidence of the film to just to be like, this is the world and this is what's happened, and it's going to get weirder from here. So like, strap in. So I really love the way it starts. The opening couple chapters were some of my favorites of the film.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's fun because I feel like, oh, sorry, go ahead, Ethan.
No, go ahead, Ben.
Well, I'll just say, I feel like Rami Youssef was kind of our, like the audience's way through this movie, because just like you said, Annie, the whole like, and obviously I had to cut the baby out. He's like, obviously, like, what do you mean? You know? So there is this like part of the world that probably would think some of this stuff is strange, but it's great that the world we're put into, which is Defoe's world, which is, you know, Bella Baxter's world, it's just accepted that you, yeah, you have a half dog, half chicken. Like, that's just a thing. That's fine. But some people from the outside might see that as strange. But yeah, I think that that's a great call.
Yeah, it feels like Yorgos is kind of walking on this like razor's edge of this comedy that he's so very, very good at. And I don't think if it wasn't Yorgos making this movie, there's no way this movie works. I think obviously we have the pieces in Mark Ruffalo and Emma Stone and everybody like fully committing, but it's that type of comedy that we get from Defoe, from these monologues, from like the very matter of fact, dark comedy of this is the world. And so obviously I took out the baby and put her brain in and Bella, like, why wouldn't I do that? And that is that full buy-in that we end up getting that makes the movie work. So much like you, Annie, I think the first couple of chapters of the film were my favorite because it has not necessarily that shock value, but like that full immersion into like, oh, I'm discovering, much like Bella is as we go through the movie, like I'm discovering this world and like who these people are and what it means to be a person with these surroundings. And I think that does really, really work. Of course, Ben, you mentioned like Rami Youssef's character is kind of our Max McCandles is like our person that we kind of operate through and trying to understand all of this until we meet Mark Ruffalo, who I think is quite sublime in this film.
He's nuts. He's nuts.
He's so, and
it's
funny.
So good. Like, he is awesome in this. His character is so interesting. I mean, just the first meeting that he has with Defoe is, I mean, that's interesting, but to immediately go and like, I've got to see who this woman is that, you know, is so important that you have to keep her caged in. And then, I mean, that was one of the, I loved, there's so many phrases that Bella says throughout the movie that I thought was hilarious. And this was even just one of them. It's like, oh, hello, visiting man. You know, she's just like, yeah, I guess that's what you would call him if you had the brain of a 2 or 3 year old or whatever, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this is the visiting man. But like the moves that he makes in that scene and then coming back and talking to like it, we just know right away, like this dude is up to something and he is fucking weird. But
what's crazy about his character is like how, when he says that, when he's like, I must know who this woman is that like you have to keep hidden. We don't know it at the time, but I feel like his motives are just like actually pretty bad. He's like, you have just a woman under your full control. I want one of those.
Yeah.
Let me go meet her.
Yeah.
And like,
exactly.
He's obsessed from her before he even meets her. Like, and so when we see his downfall later through obsession, like to see how far he falls, I think it's really funny and accurate, like to the character that they introduce, thinking back on it now.
Yeah. And to that point, all of our characters are different kind of points on this. On this very wide line of like where they fall in their, not only their relationships with Bella, but like their relationships with people and how they treat those around them. Obviously we get Ruffalo's character who is of that mindset. And then you get Max who is kind of somewhere in the middle. Like he wants to know more and wants to study her for his own knowledge, like benefit. And then we get Bella who's discovering herself, but then we also get Godwin who acts as this conduit of like a very, very much so a godlike character in Bella's life, in the world that's around, and what his viewpoint of the world is. So I think it's cool that we get someone different at different points and they all offer something for the relationships between all these characters. Who is your favorite character in the movie? I'm curious because I think the more that I think about it, I really like Max, and I think he's a really interesting part of the film.
Yeah, I think my favorite character is Bella, but when it comes to Max, when I first saw the film, I was like, "What? Mm-hmm. What are they trying to say exactly with Max?" And my conclusion was that, like, just very simply, the man that's pure of heart gets the girl. Like if you're like going to boil it down to its like most simple terms, that's sort of what I think it was trying to say. Like he respected Bella's like body as her own and her choices and didn't like judge her for them. And also was like truly in love with her in that when she returns, he's like admits that he was in love with a different version of her, but he still loves her like this new Bella too. And that was just like him showing the ultimate respect in my mind. I think that's what the movie was saying with him, but I'm curious what y'all took away from it.
Yeah, I think that totally tracks. I think this also, so much of this movie was someone living their life in a very fast, like sped
life in
up
the fast
way.
Lane.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's just like, She met the, you know, there's the trope in movies of like the guy you take home to meet your parents and the guy you have fun with, like that kind of a thing. And she like, yeah, I'll marry you, Max. That's great. But first I'm going to go on the sexual escapade with this dude. I'll be back to marry you. You know what I mean? And then like you get to benefit from this too. And it's like, I guess, you know, to some extent, that's kind of what happens, you know, in people's lives sometimes, but it's just not as point blank as this, you know, and this happens in such a fast pace. I did think that was so interesting, just all the relation to people's lives that take span over 20 years or something like that. And then she's getting it in just like months, you know, or weeks or whatever. But yeah, I thought that was, so for me, he just felt like the safety net or whatever you can come back home to, I guess.
I really like him at the end, especially the conversation that he has with Bella about like, she's come back and she's different and he was expecting a certain kind of person or relationship and that is not how things are going to go now and she needs to live the life that she needs to live essentially. So like she needs to continue to have that power over herself and his acceptance of that. I think he's a really good identifier of the fact that like people change. And obviously, like, sexual independence is a very big springboard to that for somebody. But regardless of what that might be, that idea of a person that he is constantly studying, he's constantly taking notes about, he's constantly writing about how much she eats and when she goes to bed and when she goes to bed, and like all of these types of data points, that doesn't constitute like what a person is. And I think that his storyline is really interesting in that aspect of like he is kind of just along for the ride and he sees all the evolution change and that might spark evolution in himself to be like, okay, yeah, cool, I guess, you know, people do change and like you're not the same person that I initially talked with Godwin about marrying, which I think is interesting.
And funnily enough, like while Bella's on her own, like missions, having her fun times with all the men she's with, I think it's really hilarious that Max is like meanwhile making another like monster woman that needs like teaching, and also you can like keep track of. I think that was pretty funny.
Shout out to Margaret Qualley and Christopher Abbott for being in this movie. They were in Stars at Noon together. And I think they were quite great in Stars at Noon, which has grown on me the more that I think about it. I think it was a little harsh on this pod. But yeah, I liked them being in this movie together. And I thought Margaret Qualley as like the new Bella Baxter was really good as well.
Yeah, she did a great job. She was awesome. So yeah, she says she'll go away with Ruffalo. And the first title card we get is in Lisbon. And this is where they end up. And we get some funny scenes here. We get a great dinner scene with some fellatio jokes that don't go over well with Duncan. He's like quite embarrassed. But again, it's like, she just has no filter essentially. And it's great, you know, because it starts out with her spitting out food that she just had. And then he's like, oh, you can't do that. He's like, well, if it's revolting, why would I put it in my mouth? You know? And then the lady that was like, yeah, I say the same thing to my husband, you know? And it's just like this real Rodney Dangerfield drug. Like, yeah, get a load of this guy. And it's just so funny because, you know, then Belle's like, oh, you're talking about his penis. Got it. Okay, cool. That makes sense. And it's just this whole like, yeah, that's what the joke was, but she takes it so literal. And I think that's when Duncan, he's really confused and having a hard time, like, quote unquote, keeping control of her like he thought he might be able to, because this is also where their whole sexual escapade really kicks off. There's a funny line in there now, but like they had sex 3 times. She's like, well, you can't go anymore. Like, is this some problem with the male species? You know, like, there's some
the way she phrases that question is so funny, because it's literally like if a baby learned to talk from a scientist. So it's incorrect grammar with like really high vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, is it a problem of the male species? He's like, yes.
It's so funny.
My biggest takeaway from that, and I know we'll get to it kind of at the end when we talk about Paris and the brothel, is like I walked away from that movie and I was like, I don't know, like I might need to talk to my wife. I don't know how I'm faring in the you know, in the love department. Men are just not as good, to be honest, is what I took away from this. So I don't know, a little self-reflection, I guess, that I'm a guy and I suck. I don't know.
We can't all be Mark Ruffalo, you know. It's just a lesson we all have to accept at some point.
It's true.
But yeah, then so we get that great dancing scene, which is awesome as well. So yeah, I don't know. I thought Lisbon was it was a great first section, I think, for their trip. What did you guys think about Lisbon?
I do want to point out that the first time the movie cuts to color is when she is fucking Mark Ruffalo for the first time.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Nice. So I thought that was cool. I like this chapter a lot. I liked it. Shoot, sorry, I lost my train of thought. I wanted to call out the title cards themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're so sick.
They're very cool.
Beautiful. Yeah.
I wish honestly that the movie could have pushed more into that like surrealism mm-hmm. art, because I was getting like almost Terry Gilliam vibes with this movie, and I honestly wish there was more of it. But yeah, I really liked this chapter. I really liked this movie being in montage. I feel like it moved pretty well whenever it was, and there was montage here of like Bella Baxter getting out and just doing whatever it is she wants to do. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with this one. When they danced, that was one of the many like Yorgos Lanthimisms that made this movie special. Another one that comes to mind is when Bella Baxter decides to repeatedly stab that corpse in the eyes.
Yeah.
And there was like more, and every time it would happen in the movie, I would be like, oh, Yorgos, you dog, you, like, I could just feel. And this whole dance scene feels like that at this point, because he loves putting them in his movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the dance scene a lot. I think it's really good energy and a great introduction to that energetic dynamic between Ruffalo and Stone. And I think even their conversations about like kind of what you mentioned of like, oh, we can't, like, you can't just keep going doing this all day. Like, why can't we just do this again? Like, why don't people do this all the time? That immediate like flipping it on its head of what Ruffalo thought what Duncan thought he was going to be able to do with Bella, and then for her to basically advance at like such a rapid pace that he didn't think that this was going to be something that he was going to have to deal with. And so I think that's interesting in the context of their relationship as well. I mean, Ruffalo and that stash, the dude gets it. I get it. Like I understand why they might just, you know, lock themselves in the room.
Yeah. He may have invented the mustache, right? It's hard to say. That scene though, Andy, that you talked about with her like stabbing was, just another great example of Dafoe, just his delivery of just so matter of fact, you know, she's like, Bella cut. She's like, remember only the dead ones. She's like, okay, yep. Only the dead ones. It's like, oh, they've had this conversation before.
Exactly.
Like,
this isn't the first time.
It's so, so good. And like that machine at dinner, you know, when he's like, why do you have that? He's like, oh, my dad took this stuff out of my body, so I don't have any gastric acid anymore. But he's like, not mad about it. It doesn't seem like, he's just like, matter of fact, like, yeah, my dad's a scientist too. So he branded my balls. That's just kind of what happens, you know? His delivery was so good throughout this whole movie. I loved it.
Can I ask you guys like a very heady thematic question about this movie when it comes to Godwin and what he did with Bella? So do you think that his actions of saving her and replacing her brain with her child's brain and giving her this evolutionary look at life, do you think that was beneficial for Bella, even though she wanted to die? Like, ultimately, in the grand scheme of, like, morality and, like, the world, is this a good thing that he did for Bella?
I mean, it kind of feels like it. I mean, he explains his reasoning in the movie of just, like, the woman that killed herself wouldn't want to be alive again, so there wasn't a point in bringing her back to life, even though I could have. So then, there's, like, the decision, though, to, like, not just let the baby grow up and live, but just to take the brain out of the baby and put it in the fully formed woman. Like, that's kind of weird, but I got his understanding. It was just like, well, I wasn't going to bring the woman back alive because she obviously was done. She wanted to be done. So let's start someone fresh. So I don't know. In a strange way, I got it.
Yeah, I got it too. I think too, the woman like wanted to escape. And at that point, the only means of escape was death. Had Willem Dafoe approached her and asked if she wanted to swap bodies and brains with her, with the baby inside her stomach, I can't say she would say yes to that. But I do think in the end it worked out for her or the baby, whoever she is at this point. Yeah.
From Godwin's perspective, I find this question really interesting because to me, it seems as though we mentioned what his father did to him and basically experimented on him. I wonder if this was his moral conquest to break that generational trauma that his father kind of inflicted on him of like, oh, I'm stuck burping these bubbles, or I'm stuck like basically not being able to have an erection and get off without like 8 hours of prep. And so I wonder if he saw this as his way to change that idea of what like constructing a person might be and might entail, and experimenting on somebody and use it for something good to give someone that self-autonomy that Bella ends up going through, because we get that very tender moment with them at the end where he is essentially dying. And so I think from his character's perspective, I really did like that. Do we want to talk about the ship? Move to the next scene.
In Lisbon, again, like Duncan realizes he can't really keep control like he thought he could. So he's like, I got a surprise for you. Get in this trunk. You know, she's like, all right, cool, I'll do that. Then the next scene, you know, trunk opens up and she gets out, and we realize that we are on a cruise ship. And he even says as much. He's like, yeah, it's easier for me to keep track of you if we're stuck at sea. So we're on a cruise, which she is not stoked about at all. But there's some interesting things that happen here where she meets some friends, Martha and Harry, at dinner. And they kind of open her eyes up a little bit by talking about philosophy and whether or not polite society is really worth it or really good. I thought it was a great performance from both of them, specifically Gerard Carmichael. He was really good. So it was, I don't know. I really enjoyed the whole ship sequence. I thought it worked really well.
This is where she starts reading, right? And kind of has that philosophical enlightenment of that, it opens up that other door of like what does it mean to be a person, a human, mm-hmm. participating in society that might be outside of the physical or like the sexual gratification realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's good. Sure.
What do you think of the scene, Annie?
This chapter I didn't love as much. Mm-hmm. And I think honestly, it's just because it was no longer like advancing the plot. And it was more so just like advancing Bella Baxter through, like you said, philosophy and friendship.
Yeah.
But because it wasn't advancing the plot, I was like not so hot on this. It wasn't as engaging for me.
Yeah.
I will say the moment that they do a little pit stop in Alexandria, and I just the part where she looks down and she sees there's like slaves and like poverty, and but in a very like really intense Mad Max almost style way, like people fighting over water. She sees this and she immediately like wants to run off this crazy staircase. Now this place was very surreal. I wanted more of this. And her friend catches her and is like, no, it's okay. And then later he admits that he wanted to hurt her. All of that I really, really liked. Like her wanting to like throw herself over this building because she just saw something that's so sad. It really touched me. I don't know why. Maybe just because it like pulls us out of the, what it's trying to do of like, we see this all the time and it doesn't affect us like maybe it should, like it does Bella, because she's like a child to this world.
Yeah.
That was very touching. But the friends, like I wasn't, it felt like a side quest to me.
Yeah.
Sure. I think to that effect, I agree. It did feel kind of like a little bit of a side quest. Is Martha, was that the older woman that she ends up befriending?
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed her deep, deep concern for Martha feeling sexual gratification with herself or her hand or whatever she chooses to use. I thought that was really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
From like a Yorgos Lanthimos perspective, and like it just works in that world, but also from like Bella, not, you know, 35 minutes ago, did we see her learning how to do that herself and understanding what that means for her and the pleasure that it gives her and society's perspective on that. So I think that's a really cool thing that preaches to the movie of like, she just like asked her about it, just like out in the open. They're just in the middle of this dining hall in the cruise. The last thing I wanted to say about this scene is this is where I feel like it really dives into tackling what I feel like the movie as a whole kind of works its way through, is this is Maslow's like hierarchy of needs, because we meet with Bella and she doesn't understand the world, and then as we go through it she does come up with these things like belonging and love and then esteem, cognitive, aesthetic, like she works her way through this hierarchy of understanding what the needs of a human being really, really are, and I think that this scene sparks that journey, which I think works, even if this part of the movie feels a little disjointed.
For sure. Yeah. And I think again, we kind of learn what is important to her and what her focus is, because she even introduces Duncan to Martha. This is my friend Martha. She hasn't been fucked in 20 years. He's like, okay, great. Okay. You know? But yeah, it's good to see her kind of grow throughout the whole movie. We have a scene later on where Duncan is gambling his money away, basically. Doesn't look like he's doing well at all. And this is as the slum scene is happening. And then we turn around, come back from the slums, and we see Ruffalo just like passed out on the bed. And it turns out he won all this money. And then Bella just like gathers it all up. She's like, I'm just going to go give it to these people. And then these two kind of ship people, whatever, they're like, we'll take care of it, don't worry. You know, they kind of like the garage attendants in Ferris Bueller, like, yeah, we'll take your car, we'll park it, don't worry. And that just leads to them getting kicked off in Marseille, where they eventually end up in Paris, and we begin this whole new sequence. But I think overall, I agree. I think this ship is like, as far as title card sequences go, maybe the lower of them. But I do still think there was some interesting stuff that kind of happened here.
Mm-hmm.
But then we end up in Paris and she learns that she can have sex for money. And that just leads to this whole chapter here, which is like, she says it as much. She's like, I need sex and I need money. So this works out perfectly. Which you know, first leads to Duncan just losing his mind that she would do something like this. But then obviously leads her to go back to the brothel and work there for a while to save up money. What did you guys think about the sequence? Cause there's so much that happens here. We learn, she learns a lot, you know, like, I mean, I think the very first customer is like, shouldn't we get me warmed up a little bit? You know, it's just like, no, that's not how, this isn't Duncan anymore. This is something completely different. But she makes some good friendships with the other women there as well. But yeah, what did you guys think about the parent sequence? What about you, Annie?
To me, this felt like another sequence of the boat where it's like, she's going to learn more things and expand. And the plot again here to me wasn't that much. It wasn't driven that forward. Mm-hmm. It just in this chapter and then the previous one. That being said, I think I had more fun with this chapter. I don't know why. I mean, when the leader of the brothel, I forget that actress's name, but when she says like a woman charting her way to freedom, I love it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I felt that too. I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
And I love like Bella, like becoming like a socialist and making friends. And then Duncan, like, I love seeing the fall of Duncan. And at this point, my mind's like, where is this going? Like, where are we going from here? I didn't expect to come here and I didn't expect to go to the boat. So where are we going to go from here? And I wouldn't have guessed. So, but I like that, honestly. But yeah, that's what I thought.
This brothel scene is my favorite scene in the whole movie. It's my favorite like amalgamation of scenes. I think it's probably because it does remind me the most of like Belle de Jour and the happenings of that film. So I saw the most crossover in this one. I am just consistently a proponent of like more sex in movies. And of course this is doing that. And I think it's doing it very smartly and well and provocatively. And it works on like an entire level. So for me to see something like this pulled off very successfully, especially in a Yorgos Lanthimos film in which like the world is more surreal, but the ideas and themes that we're processing and working through of like powering our way to freedom, those are very real. And like, those are very applicable things that we can pull from this film. I think it works as a whole really, really well for me. Obviously it helps that Emma Stone is completely like lights out gorgeous. I love her long black hair, the costuming. I think this is the best kind of stint of costuming that we get from all of the other, the patrons of the brothel and everything that we get to see. And all of this come to find out she had emergency money that she could have just used in the beginning, which I think is really funny to me and really insightful to the things that matter to Bella and like what she wants to pursue to feel her most authentic self. Obviously, we get the downfall of Ruffalo and him encapsulating like maybe this societal white male view of like what that means for a woman and trying to dictate what that means for Bella when he has no right or power to do so. And I think it's absolutely hysterical and ridiculous that a father brings his two sons into a brothel to watch him get fucked.
Just give the tutorial.
Just crazy stuff, honestly.
I mean, there are some funny moments in here, like especially that guy comes in and they do the lineup and then she steps forward. Like, what if the women picked? Like, wouldn't you be stoked if one of us picked you rather than you picking us? Like, wouldn't that be more exciting for you? Wouldn't that be kind of cool? And then there's another client later on where she's like, okay, here's what's going to happen. You're going to tell me a childhood story. I'm going to tell you a joke. I'm going to smell you and make sure you smell okay. And then like, let's build some rapport before we get into this. There's like, I really liked her, like that growth throughout these things where she's like, okay, I'm going to take a little control back here. But it's all done just in a very humorous and very funny way. So
yeah, this is where we see as well. Her name is Catherine Hunter. Annie, I think you were searching for that. Her name is Swiney in this movie. She plays in the tragedy of Macbeth. She plays like one of the witches, very, very excellent actor.
She plays all three witches, right? Doesn't she? Isn't she?
I believe so. Yeah. So, that's right. And she's excellent in this movie as well. Are her tattoos, are those real tattoos or was that part of the movie? Because I was sold either way.
I'm pretty sure it's part of the movie.
Damn.
But they look legit.
They were cool. Yeah.
They look really good on her.
those were good tattoo work. Sometimes they just look fresh and black, and it's like, this is not a tattoo at all, man. This is, yeah, hers were great. So yeah, now we get to the point where Godwin has fallen ill, and calls for her to come back. And it's funny because this also reminds me of all the letters that we see back and forth, and how she just kind of just says simple phrases like bit hairy, mouth full of blood, you know, just like things like that. And the way Godwin like tells us to her, it's like, Godwin's sick, RIP soon, or something like that. Yeah. You know, she's like, oh, okay, I guess I better go home. So she goes back to London, and she's like, oh, you're sick. He's like, no, I'm not sick, I'm dying. You know, again, that's the doctor side of him. It's just gonna be very pragmatic about it, and very straightforward. And then her reconnecting with Max, which I thought was really, really interesting, because it felt like he was like, no, I'm not going to like make you hold true to what you said before. You were a lot younger then, like things are totally different. But then it turned where she proposes to him. She's like, well, I still want to be with you, kind of thing. So let's do this. So, yeah, obviously that leads to the wedding, which leads us meeting Christopher Abbott.
Wild.
And what a scene that is, with Ruffalo hiding behind him. just so, so crazy. What did you think about this whole wedding sequence, Annie?
Oh, man, I loved that wedding sequence, and I loved this whole chapter. The plot is back, baby. We're back in the plot. We're so back. Christopher Abbott, I didn't know he was in this movie when I saw it.
Yeah.
Whenever he shows up, God, I love every time he shows up in something. I love Christopher Abbott. He's so awesome. So when he showed up, I'm like, of course we're going to meet the husband. I didn't think, right. I don't know why I ever thought we weren't going to meet the husband. Like, that's how it felt. And she agrees to go with him, and is trying to like figure out what kind of guy he was, and also why she would try to kill herself, because by this point she knows she did that. And I loved that discovery, and like how the stakes were being raised, of like the threat increased like slowly, whether it was there the whole time. She was like, she was like starting to figure out the threat, like how he was like the help are like organizing an uprising, I think. And then she finds out why, and it's because they were terrible people, and that's why she wanted to kill herself. And then all the way to like genital mutilation, which is like crazy, but also very fitting for this movie, and like with the sexual freedom, like themes within, it's like a perfect physical threat for Bella to have to face. So I loved that whole chapter. I thought it moved really quickly. I thought it moved quicker than almost all the other chapters.
So but fast.
Yes. Yeah. But I really liked the pace. It was really awesome.
Abbott really fit well within this world. And I agree. I think he's getting a reputation now where it's like, oh, cool, Christopher Abbott's in the movie. Like that something good is going to go down. Like, you know, he's going to bring something special. So I had the same reaction when he showed up. I was very surprised. Very much same mindset of like, oh yeah, of course we're gonna understand more of her backstory. Like, that, why would we have gotten that in the beginning if we're not gonna kind of circle back to this and really do go full circle with everything? I love that he literally shoots himself in the foot with his gun, and I think that is more of that like dark comedy from Yorgos that really really works, and like some of those practical gags. It did feel very quick, but I thought that was a smart way to wrap the movie and to kind of speed us up through what we've spent so much time like focusing on through the rest of the film, and not use like the final 20 minutes to like meander or like really deeply think about, okay, what has the last 90 minutes been about, or the last 2 hours been about? Like, I think that was a good way to get back to the plot and to make something really interesting happen. And then obviously we get the ending, and Christopher Abbott's character gets turned into a fucking goat, right?
Yeah,
or like whatever. And we see Bella like sipping a martini and kind of like running Godwin's house, and Max is still there. And I thought it was a really satisfying and humorous ending to see Bella use what she's learned and constitute that to be like, okay, now I'm like running a house of freedom where like I put people in their place and I help the people that need it and deserve it. And we're going to help the next Bella and these types of things. So I thought it wrapped really well. And the energy that Christopher Abbott brought was completely different from something we'd seen in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
Up until that point, which I liked.
Yeah. I thought it was a nice ending, you know, just wrap up with a bow on it. Her friend from the brothel came to live with them. She's, mm-hmm. you know, reading and educating herself even more. Everyone's just kind of living in harmony, and it's a beautiful backyard, to say the very least, man. I'd hang out back there anytime. So I thought it was a great ending. And this, I mean, it's got a runtime of 220. So this is kind of a fast paced ending, but any longer, you know, you may have felt the runtime on it, but as it was at 220, I didn't feel like I had been there that long. I think it moves along nicely.
Yeah. And it's so funny too, that it just like kind of keeps you on the hook the whole time. Annie, what is your true cinema moment? If you had to pick one thing that's your favorite.
Oh, one moment. I'm going to go with when we learn about how Bella was created. Not only just like the lines are hilarious, but the shots, seeing her being made and like the brain, very provocative. I loved it.
Yeah.
I like that. What about you, Ben?
I mean, it's hard not to love almost everything in Lisbon, but specifically just calling him out for not being able to go for a fourth round because of the physiological problem with the male species. Like, this is, yeah, you know, I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, no, not wrong. Not wrong at all. I think outside of the brothel, which like vastly was like my favorite sequence of things, I do like in Lisbon when she goes out on her own because this male problem, and Duncan is taking a nap, and she goes out on her own and she eats and she explores, and kind of that's the first time we see her doing things in a society independently and realizing like, oh, maybe Duncan was right. Like maybe I shouldn't eat another one of those things. But he's wrong about certain things as well. And so like her discovering that, and that's really where we get the full Yorgos treatment of what that place looks like, which is very, very cool to watch. Very surreal world, which is fun. Okay. I like Poor Things quite a lot. I don't think it's going to win Best Picture, but I am very, very excited and happy that it's even in the conversation, considering the mature content that it focuses on and the mature themes that it resonates with, I think is really important. You guys want to quickly talk about the best cinematography race?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, of course, we're just guessing what's going to be nominated. So hopefully we're right. We'll see. And if not, we'll have a fun little make-believe. This is what things might have been. So Poor Things, we think, is going to be nominated for best cinematography. Of course, this comes from cinematographer Robbie Ryan. The other four ones that are currently predicted and on the slate to be nominated are El Conde, Edward Lachman, and that's a Netflix production, Killers of the Flower Moon, Rodrigo Prieto, Maestro, Matthew Libatic, and Oppenheimer, Hoyte van Hoytema. Five very quite prominent cinematography names. So Annie, to what you were saying like at the beginning of the episode, it does feel like this kind of year where things are just stacked. Like we just have a lot of very, very good options everywhere we go. Next in line, right outside those five, is Saltburn, The Zone of Interest, and Barbie. Those are like slots 6, 7, and 8 right now, based on predictions. Annie, I'll start with you. What five do you think are going to be nominated, and what movie do you think will win Best Cinematography?
I'm going to say Killers of Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, Zone of Interest.
Mm.
And I think that Oppenheimer, Hoyte van Hoytema, is going to win this. That's my prediction as of right now.
It's a good prediction. I'm going to steal the floor, and I'm going to say I was literally going to say the exact same thing.
Nice.
So I got nothing to add to that conversation. That's 100% how it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I was leaving my fifth spot open. I haven't seen El Conde, and I've, you know, who am I to tell Clayton that it's not a good selection? But Zone of Interest definitely seems like something that could play in there. Robbie Ryan, though, just very briefly, like he's done some A24 stuff that we've talked about on the pod. He did Come On, Come On. He did.
Oh, I did not know that. That's really intriguing.
He did Medusa Deluxe, which is kind of that Warner movie that we watched, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And American Honey, along with others like Marriage Story and stuff like that. So great cinematographer.
Yeah. Really good cinematographer. I think the Zone of Interest will definitely get in this five. I'm really curious to see when the nominations come out, if it's going to be in there. We're not going to be predicting our Best Picture winners or nominees today, because by the time this episode comes out, those will already be out in the world. So kind of a futile exercise, really. Do we have any other thoughts on Poor Things before we wrap up? Anything that didn't get said or that you wanted to mention?
I mean, not for me. I think we covered everything. I think a lot of great performances. As mentioned earlier, I wouldn't be surprised if all three of those acting noms happened. Because I think mm-hmm. Willem Dafoe is great, Ruffalo is great, and obviously Emma Stone did a wonderful job. So very curious to see what kind of noms this movie ends up with.
Yeah, I have nothing more to say about Poor Things. I'm just really excited to see what Yorgos does next.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Same here. Very curious to see what happens after Poor Things. And probably one of his more critically acclaimed films, at least compared to like The Lobster and The Killing of a Sacred Deer. I know, obviously, The Favorite, quite critically acclaimed as well. So he's on a pretty good streak right now. So I'd be really curious to see what comes next for him. Annie,
oh,
thanks for...
sorry. Super quick.
Yeah.
Because
I gave you your time, so no, you're done. You're off.
Yorgos' next movie says it's completed.
What?
Called Stop. Kinds of Kindness with Emma Stone, Willem Dafoe, Jesse Plemons, Hunter Schafer, Margaret Qualley, Hong Chow. Like,
Hong Chow supremacy. Let's go.
Yeah, coming back.
What are they making this one on the weekends? Like,
what are we doing?
Honestly, the plot line literally says plot kept under wraps. So no idea what it's about, that cast, I'm super stoked. But
IMDb says it's completed.
Kinds of Kindness.
Kinds of Kindness. Oh, that's fascinating. I literally have not heard about this at all. I think that's very interesting.
There's been some press leaked photos and stuff. They've been shooting it, but.
An upcoming anthology film directed by Yorgos Lanthimos from a screenplay he co-wrote. That's literally all Google says. Dude, yeah. Hunter Schafer and Hung Chow, though, I'm so fucking in.
Yeah, it's going
to
be
awesome. Incredible.
Sorry, I just had to put that out there.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
No, I'm glad.
That was good.
But.
That was worth it. Approved. That was definitely worth the time. Annie, thanks for coming on the show. Such a delight to have you. If people want to find more of you, where can they find you at?
Yeah, you can find Movie Mavens, my podcast, anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can find me on Instagram at Annie_Janes, and you can find Movie Mavens on Twitter at Movie Mavens.
Spicy nice. Double feature.
Spicy yeah, double feature. Let's go.
I love
Super
it.
Great. Great pod. Highly recommend checking out the show. Next week on this pod, we're going heartfelt. Ben, we're talking about The Holdovers. Number 5 on our best picture slate. I'm pretty excited. I'm interested to see how our conversation goes.
Yeah, we'll be halfway through. I got to read Marcus Aurelius before then, but other than that, I'm ready to go. Yeah, good.
Other than that, I'm going to turn that into a Big Fat Liar pod. That's the only, okay. That's the only plan that I have for that episode. I'm excited. Yeah, cool.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah, you want to close this out, Ben?
Yeah, I'm losing my mind. I'm thinking about meditations now, so.
You went into your own space.
Yeah, I know. Giamatti, you know, he just gets on the brain and already at work. That's what
it is.
You
drift away. It's working.
Yeah, I'm just like, you know what? I got to vote for him. I don't even have a vote, and I got to vote for Giamatti.
I'm thinking about In-N-Out over here. I'm starved.
Exactly.
It's dinner time.
Let us know what you guys thought about this episode about Poor Things. What awards do you think it's going to take home from the Oscars? Is it going to win Best Picture? I don't know. It's a challenge, but it's going to be nominated, pretty sure. So let us know what you think. We're on Twitter and Instagram at 24 Minutes of 824. And you can also watch us on YouTube. Subscribe to us there. Next week, when we talk about The Holdovers, you can see if I have a lazy eye that moves from left to right. You know, it's hard to say. That's the only way.
Which one do I
out.
Look at? I'm not sure.
Which one? Yeah. Which one do you look at? So subscribe to us there. Thanks, everyone, for your support. I am Ben Lawhorn.
And I am Ethan Simi. I must go punch that baby.